Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Mel Goodman, former CIA analyst and senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, who assesses how Iraq's recent parliamentary elections may affect the war and U.S. occupation. Greg Rollins, a member of the Christian Peacemaker team living in Iraq, discusses how his group has responded to the kidnapping of four of his colleagues. And Kit Gage, director of the First Amendment Foundation, who looks at press reports and President Bush's admission that his administration has, in violation of federal law, spied on U.S. citizens without court authorization. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In a speech celebrating Human Rights Day, United Nations Human Rights Commissioner Louise Arbour declared the global ban on torture had become a victim of the war on terrorism. Arbour, a former Canadian Supreme Court justice, identified two odious practices: rendition, or the practice of transferring suspects to a court where they are likely to be tortured, and holding prisoners in secret detention. John Bolton, the American ambassador to the UN, blasted Arbour, saying it was inappropriate and illegitimate for an international civil servant to second-guess the conduct the U.S. has been engaged in the war on terror. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan quickly defended his human rights chief and pledged to bring up the topic directly with Bolton. Arbour's address on the theme of torturers and terrorists was given 3 days before Human Rights Day, celebrated on December 10th, the day in 1948 the UN ratified the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The 1994 UN Treaty on Torture prohibits certain practices that do not meet the legal definition of torture. Included are techniques that human rights groups say the U.S. has used at its detention center in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Arbour urged the Bush administration to allow each detainee the right to an attorney of their choice and free access to American courts. Led by progressive evangelical Jim Wallace, editor of Sojourners, a Christian journal, hundreds of members of mainline church denominations like the United Church of Christ and the United Methodist Church protested proposed cuts to the poor in the 2006 federal budget in front of a congressional office building. Before Congress left for Christmas break, they approved $42 billion in cuts over 5 years with reductions in Medicare and student loans. Food stamp funding was preserved. Wallace told the Washington Post, "The leaders of the religious right were withholding their opposition to the budget cuts in exchange for support for socially conservative judges." Meanwhile, Congress has pushed through billions of dollars in tax cuts for America's wealthiest citizens. Acting GOP House Majority Leader Roy Blunt, Republican of Missouri, countered that lowering taxes on investors will boost the economy and improve the lives of poor people. Tony Perkins, head of the Family Research Council, says defending welfare benefits is less vital than halting human slavery. While agreeing that there is a biblical mandate to take care of the poor, Perkins maintains that the Bible doesn't say government should do it. Nearly 30 years after he wrote the first lethal injection law in the country, former Oklahoma state legislator Bill Wiseman has regrets. "I am sorry for what I did," Wiseman recently told Mother Jones magazine. "I hope someday to offset it by helping us realize that capital punishment is wrong and self-destructive." As a young politician in the mid-70s, Wiseman, who attended a Quaker school as a teenager, wanted to make the newly reimposed death penalty in conservative Oklahoma more humane. He worked with the state medical examiner Jay Chapman on creating a liquid drip to induce death. The system was later adopted by 37 states and is now the most widely used method for executing death row inmates. Over the last 20 years, over 800 people were killed with lethal injection versus 168 people using other means like the electric chair or the gas chamber. Opponents of the death penalty are now trying to make the case that lethal injection is cruel and unusual punishment. A recent study in the scientific journal The Lancet looked at medical reports of executed inmates in four states. Those killed by lethal injection had a lower level of anesthetic than required for surgery. If a prisoner is conscious during the execution, the pain from potassium chloride, the agent used in lethal injections, is similar to boiling oil or a branding iron. Wiseman, who is now an ordained Anglican priest, says, "The problem is that we're killing people. That's what's wrong, not how we're doing it." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino.
Iraq's December 15th parliamentary election saw an estimated 11 million Iraqis cast ballots for representatives that will form a new four-year government. President Bush touted the success of the election, which was conducted with reduced levels of violence and the participation of large numbers of Sunni Muslims that had largely boycotted prior votes. Early returns indicated that with two-thirds of the votes counted, the main Shiite religious party coalition with strong ties to Iran would dominate any new government. The party of Mr. Bush's ally, former Prime Minister Ayad Alawi, was trailing behind a Sunni coalition party that supports resistance to the occupation and a withdrawal of American forces. In a December 18th televised address to a nation increasingly opposed to the war, President Bush asked for patience and resolve in fighting insurgents in Iraq, but failed to lay out any timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. troops. While acknowledging some disagreements about his decision to launch the war, Mr. Bush went on to label some of his critics as defeatists. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with former CIA analyst Mel Goodman, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. He assesses Iraq's recent parliamentary election and how it may affect the war and U.S. occupation.
I think what the administration has done for various, fairly obvious reasons, is to oversell the importance of this election. But at the same time, the critics of the war, and I've been a strong critic of the war before there was a war, have to acknowledge that to hold an election and have 10 million people vote is important, just as it was in Moscow in 1989. But as we've seen, the problem in the Soviet Union came after 1989, and I'm afraid the problems in Iraq are going to come after this election in 2005. So we're going to know some things fairly soon.
Mel Goodman, one of the points President Bush made in his speech was that the overthrow of Saddam Hussein and the war against the insurgents will produce a strong ally for the United States in the future in the very critical area of the Middle East. But there are many analysts who look at the probable makeup of a new Iraqi government after these elections that may very well be strongly aligned with the nation of Iran, labeled by this president as part of the axis of evil. What do you see down the line in terms of the probability that we're going to have a Shia-controlled government there that is very friendly with the mullahs in Tehran?
Well, there's an inherent contradiction in everything that President Bush says. On the one hand, he talks about democracy, that we're going to democratize Iraq. Well, you're looking at a country that's over 60% Shia. So it stands to reason that if democracy really takes in Iraq, you're going to see a Shia government. If you look at the Shia leadership in turn, then you find out that virtually every major Shia leader, every major cleric, every leader of a military a group that's independent of the Iraqi National Army, either was educated in Iran, born in Iran, grew up in Iran, spent some formative years in Iran, has serious patrons in Iran. So therefore, not only is it obvious that we're going to get a Shia government of one type or another, but it's most likely that we will get a Shia government that's aligned with Iran. Now, if we've overthrown Saddam Hussein and deployed 160,000 American servicemen and women in Iraq and spent over $250 billion in addition to what's in the defense budget, to have a Shia government aligned with Iran to form a very strong Islamic coalition in the Persian Gulf, I can't think of a more disastrous situation for American national security interests. Granted, Saddam Hussein was an extremely evil figure and a figure of incredible discontinuity in the Middle East, but there are certain things he kept a lid on, and one was terrorism and insurgency in his own country, and he wasn't a threat to the United States in terms of his support for terrorism. He had nothing to do with 9/11. He had no links to al-Qaeda. He had no personal relationship with Osama bin Laden. Now, instead of Saddam Hussein, we're going to have this Shia government with ties to Iran, and the problems for the United States will just begin in a very serious way. So was it worth overthrowing Saddam Hussein? Well, I'd say it's good that he's not around, but the price was far too much. We've paid too much in terms of treasure. We've paid too much in terms of blood, and we've paid too much in terms of the stability of American national security policy. I just can't approve of the kind of price that we're paying. And for this to be called a victory under any circumstances becomes essentially rather ludicrous.
What do you see as the tipping point for a full-blown civil war in Iraq, if it's not already ongoing, in your view?
Well, I think we're already seeing the signs of civil war. So I don't know if there's any real tipping point. A lot of people feel the tipping point would be an American withdrawal, but that's what would lead Iraq to engage in full-blown civil war. But I think Iraqis know full well what happened in the Balkans after the demise of Tito, and they certainly know what happened in Lebanon in the wake of this Syrian involvement in Lebanon and the Israeli intervention in Lebanon in the early 1980s. And I do think they want to avoid those situations. And that's why I think if we announced a timely withdrawal over a protracted period, it would give them time to get their own house in order and to work more effectively at using the wonderful middle class that Iraq was developing over the last 20 years, as well as the excellent bureaucracy that they had, because they had a more interesting infrastructure in Iraq than most other Arab countries in the Middle East. And it would be reason to get their house in order to prepare for that day when the United States was going to leave. The longer we stay, the longer they have the notion that the United States will do these things for them. The United States will take up the military challenge because that's what they're there for, and the Iraqis don't have to bother with this. So I think some sign of U.S. Withdrawal would be the clear signal and maybe the tipping point in an opposite direction to get people prepared for trying to create some stabilization index in Iraq, and that's what needs to take place.
Should the United States, and maybe it's already occurring, should the United States be engaged in diplomatic negotiations with the insurgent groups in Iraq to prepare for a U.S. withdrawal?
Oh, I think the United States should be working as aggressively at this as anything else they're doing. It's very important to reach out to the insurgents. I'm not talking about the terrorists. I'm not talking about Zarqawi, but I'm talking about the insurgents. I'm talking about impressing those people who are former Baathists to make it clear to them that the United States doesn't want access to the oil holdings in the country. The United States doesn't want access to the permanent bases because we are building 14 major military facilities in this country, and we've never disavowed an interest in these military bases for our own permanent presence. All this has to be signaled to the insurgents, and at the same time, the majority Shia community must understand that it's important for the Sunni minority to have some hope for some viable political role in this new nation. I think that is essential, and I think it would be the threat of violence and a worsening of violence that could lead all of the sides in this very complicated equation to come to the table and maybe negotiate some of these differences.
That was Mel Goodman, a former CAA analyst and senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Contact the center by calling area code 202-232-3317 or visit their website at www.ciponline.org. On November 26th, four long-term volunteers with the Christian Peacemaker Team in Iraq were kidnapped by a group calling itself the Swords of Righteousness Brigade. The kidnappers threatened to kill the four men, two Canadians, an American, and a Briton, if the U.S. and Britain did not release all Iraqi prisoners they hold. Deadlines have come and gone, but the kidnappers, as of the date of this report, have not yet carried out their threat. Since 1984, CPT has sent teams to conflict zones around the world, employing direct action to reduce violence and protect human rights. Members of the CPT in Iraq have responded to President George Bush's call to stay the course in Iraq by calling on the U.S. to pull its military out of the occupied nation. They also remind the world that kidnapping has affected far more Iraqis than it has foreigners, and they say this lack of security is directly related to the ongoing military occupation of Iraq. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Greg Rollins, a Canadian who has lived in Iraq almost 3 years. Speaking from Baghdad, he describes the day-to-day work of the Christian Peacemaker teams, how the group has responded to the kidnappings of their colleagues, and the impact the foreign military occupation has had on ordinary Iraqis.
Daily life for us pretty much consists of doing our work. Usually it is talking with Iraqis, meeting with Iraqis to discuss, you know, human rights work or human rights violations, or working with organizations to maybe do some sort of demonstration, work on a demonstration, or go to the city of Fallujah to document, you know, stuff that's been happening there or is happening there. Or it can be working with people who are trying to find loved ones who have been arrested by U.S. and or Iraqi forces, or I should say multinational forces instead of just U.S. forces. And so sometimes we end up going to military bases with them or going to a ministry office to try and track down their loved one who was arrested and hasn't been heard from since.
I understand that people from the Christian Peacemaker teams have a good working relationship with many Iraqis. Can you just describe a little bit about how Iraqis on the street view you?
Whenever we first meet Iraqis, they are a little suspicious or uncertain about who we are. We do carry a sheet with us in Arabic and in English that explains who we are and who we are not, and it explains what we do and what we don't do. And from that, Iraqis get a very good picture or idea of, you know, who we are and what we're trying to achieve. But we do have very good relations with the people that we work with, because they have the same goals and the same objectives that we do, you know, trying to work on things through nonviolence and trying to expose or document or make known the human rights abuses that are happening here.
Were you surprised when your four colleagues were kidnapped? Do you feel relatively safe there because of the work you're doing, or do you feel like your lives are in danger all the time?
Well, no, we weren't surprised when our colleagues were taken. I mean, we were shocked, but that's because the actual, you know, that's something you go through when this first happens. But to say that we never imagined it would happen to us would be kind of foolish, because we always said, you know, we're no more different than anybody else. We're foreigners, and just by being foreigners here, you are eligible to be for being a target. Do I feel any different? Well, I feel a little different that now that it's happened, but the same as before it happened. I'm not going to let that fear control me, or I'm not going to let my apprehension control my actions. At the same time, I'm not going to be reckless and go running into places that I shouldn't go if my friends tell me not to, or if I don't feel it's a good idea.
Greg Rollins, your organization has reached out to everyone you can think of to try to help convince the kidnappers to release your colleagues. Can you say anything more specific about how that's gone, what you've done, and what you're still planning to do?
Well, what we've done is we've asked a lot of our Iraqi work partners and friends to write statements on our behalf, and try and get them on as much media, Iraqi media, as possible, as well as, you know, we've put them up on our website in English and in Arabic. And we've asked the same of a lot of our friends throughout the Middle East, in Jordan and in Palestine, because we have a team in Palestine as well, and throughout the world, whether they be Muslim or Christian or secular groups or whatever kind of groups, we've asked, you know, for their support. And you know, our hope is that seeing this, those who took our colleagues will, you know, reconsider what they've done and hopefully let them go and just release them so that we can continue doing our work.
Do you have any opinion about the December 15th elections? Do you think the fact that they went pretty smoothly will have any bearing on the release of your colleagues?
I'm not sure what bearing the elections will have on the safety of my colleagues or the release of my colleagues. It's hard to say. The group that has taken them hasn't really said enough for us to get a picture of that. As for the elections themselves, well, I was happy that they went off smoothly without any problems. I was happy to see a good turnout. But what remains to be seen is what kind of government will be formed.
Finally, do you have any sense from your work whether the number of Iraqis arrested and imprisoned has increased, decreased, or stayed about the same over the past several months?
At the end of this month, I'm not sure exactly when, but at the end of this month, the U.S. Army will be opening a fourth prison here in Iraq. It'll be in the north. I'm not sure what the name of it is, but it was projected that, you know, by the end of this year, the U.S. forces, or multinational forces, sorry, would be able to hold up to 16,000 prisoners. So I would say from that that the amount of people being imprisoned is rising.
That was Greg Rollins of the Christian Peacemaker Team in Iraq. Contact the group by calling area code 773-277-0253 or visit their website at www.cpt.org. Political firestorm is gathering in Washington after the New York Times published a story on December 16th revealing that President Bush in 2002 had secretly authorized the National Security Agency to spy on American citizens through electronic eavesdropping, bypassing a federal law requiring court-approved warrants. The surveillance of international phone calls and email was purportedly conducted to identify terrorist groups and prevent attacks. The New York Times delayed reporting on the story for a year after the White House requested that it not be published. Many congressional Democrats, some Republicans, and civil liberties advocates maintain that the president has violated a 1978 federal law that mandates that all electronic monitoring be approved by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. Separately, documents obtained by the ACLU under a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit confirm that the FBI has been spying on U.S. environmental, religious, and animal rights groups such as Greenpeace, PETA, and Catholic workers' communities. In response to the NSA spy story, Mr. Bush confirmed his approval of surveillance without court warrants and vowed to continue the practice. The president asserted that government monitoring of citizens was authorized by a 2001 congressional resolution to use all necessary force against terrorists responsible for the 9/11 attacks. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Kit Gage, director of the First Amendment Foundation, who explains why she believes President Bush's action is a grave violation of the U.S. Constitution and represents an impeachable offense.
I think this is a fabulous civics lesson because it gets to the balance of powers, it gets to the role of the Congress and the courts, and it underscores the critical nature of how this country was founded with three branches of government to try to make sure that we don't have a dictatorship. Mr. Bush has admitted that he has authorized the National Security Agency, NSA, to wiretap communications from U.S. persons, which can be citizens or non-citizens, from the U.S. to other countries and vice versa. This isn't what we think of the NSA doing, which is sort of keyword intercepts, but rather regular old wiretaps. The government has a really long history of abusing people's rights and abusing technology. The NSA was spying on Vietnam War dissenters in the 60s and 70s, you know, as part of the Nixon administration's authorizations. And that blew up in Nixon's face, and the result was the FISA law, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which created a court, the FISA court, which the government was required to use, not in criminal investigations, but in terrorism kinds of investigations, at that point during the Cold War, but it's really a direct connection to the terrorism investigations. You had to go to that court to get permission to do wiretaps of people you thought had a connection to a foreign power. That's been expanded to do terrorism wiretaps. So there has been this modification to recognize that we're in a different technological era. But nonetheless, Mr. Bush said and has now stated publicly that he signed, repeatedly signed, every 45 days, signed an executive order to violate, to intentionally violate the FISA Act and order the NSA to do these wiretaps. And he apparently told a couple people in Congress, although they're now saying, some of them are saying that they weren't told the extent of this. But he didn't go to the Congress and say, you know, I don't have enough authority under FISA. You need to give me more authority so that I can do emergency wiretaps. He didn't do that. He just blatantly violated the law and quite clearly the Constitution, violating the, which tells it that the government cannot do searches without due process.
Kit Gage, President Bush justifies what he did in terms of bypassing the FISA courts by saying the post-9/11 world is a very dangerous place and he had to do what he had to do in order to protect this country. There are many people in this nation that may very well believe that. But what is the danger of a president having unchecked powers to spy on Americans or to render civilians in this country or other countries to secret prisons and to employ torture and all the other things we've seen throughout this Bush presidency?
You're right. It raises the same kinds of concerns. There's only one way that people have, ordinary folks, you and me, to make sure that our government doesn't become a dictatorship. And that is to hold it to the Constitution, to the Bill of Rights, and to the law. You know, when a president, as Mr. Bush has just very explicitly done, says, we're at an endless war on terror, and that gives me the authority to secretly violate the law and violate the Constitution. You know, with the exception of when people start leaking this information, it gives us no ability to stop that unharnessed power. And if now, when this has become public, if the Congress doesn't hold hearings and pass a law telling the president he can't do this, and if the courts don't opine in the same way, then it's going to be really hard to uphold the Constitution in this whole area. And not only that, it's going to be a scary place when the president can set that kind of a precedent and not be held accountable by the Congress or the courts.
What happens next, Kit Gage? What can the Congress do? What should the Congress do to check this seeming abuse of presidential power?
Well, they certainly need to get a bunch of questions answered. It looks like some of the questions are being answered. Mr. Bush is admitting a lot of this stuff. We need to understand what the rationale is from the Attorney General and who else authorized this. And I would argue if this turns out to be as serious as it looks today, I think that's an impeachable offense. I don't see any way around it. If the president says, you know, he has intentionally violated a constitutionally grounded law, and the argument is, you know, I'm violating it because we all figured out that they wouldn't let me do what I wanted to do, you know, that is a direct violation of what he's sworn to do. And, you know, and I think it's going to be interesting to see what this Congress does with this information, because it's spying on people is recognized by both the right and the left, not to mention various folks in the middle, as being a really serious problem.
That was Kit Gage, director of the First Amendment Foundation. Contact the foundation by calling area code 202-529-4225 or visit their website at www.firstamend.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.vtlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.